Final set in reel four. How did this story finally resolve itself?
Well, I did try to press for to get more interest taken in this thing, but without result. I then consulted my friend Mr. Butement in SRD. Now, Mr. Butement immediately saw the possibilities in this, and he advised me that if the service authorities were not going to pursue the matter, he advised me to take out a provisional patent. Well, I talked to my own commanding officer about this, and he said, "Well, there it is. I don't see why you shouldn't pursue this." In point of fact, he obtained permission for me to do this from the War Office, and I received a letter, in fact, saying that as the services were not interested in the in the idea, there would be nothing to prevent me from going ahead and taking out a patent. So I consulted a lawyer, and I was told how to set about this. I put my papers in for a provisional patent, and in the course of time, this came through, and I received it. Meanwhile, Mr. Butement, having been struck by the possibilities of further development of this, set out on his own account to design this idea into the new number 11 set, which he was in process of designing for general use in the army and for use as well in the in armored vehicles. But he was very decent about it. He avoided using precisely the same technique as mine, and he developed a system which subsequently was put into use in all the new range of sets, including the number 19, which eventually came into use throughout the Armored Corps and in the Army generally. By the time that all this happened, the war was clearly approaching. I was posted away from my appointment with the Armored Corps, and I was unable to spend the money necessary to proceed with my patent beyond the provisional stage. And when the war came, the matter dropped. But I did discover, when the number 9 set appeared in use, that my netting device, exactly as I had originally proposed it, was incorporated in the number 9 set. I did protest about this later on, and at the end of the war, I think it was the end of the war, or it might have been possibly during the course of it, eventually I received a letter from the War Office saying that note had been taken of this device and offering me £100 for the
patent.
Well, not for the patent really, but offering me £100 to consider the matter closed, provided that I didn't go any further with it. And I, so needing the money at the time, I agreed, and that was the end of it. But it still strikes me as very odd that the powers that be should have failed to appreciate how important this could be for wireless communication within the army and within the service generally. And I remain equally amazed at well, now looking back.
I wondered whether a brigade level, where you had problems of communication between nets, whether those were any different in character, in principle, from the problems of netting the battalion only.
This raises, I think, quite a different problem. The brigadier wants to be able to talk to his battalion commanders, regimental commanders. Using the rear link, he cannot do so directly, or could not. So the problem arose, toward the end, really, I suppose, of my time with the tank brigade, of arranging or providing some system whereby direct contact could be made between the brigade commander and his battalion commander. Well, now, the first step in this direction, clearly, was to have another set, wireless set, to communicate between the rear-link tank and the command tank. And this was eventually a sort of solution that was provided by the design of a new set with very short range, which I think was called the number 14 set, which SRD designed for the purpose. This had a range only of, I think, a few hundred yards. It was designed to have that range, so that at least a message could be relayed from the officer in the rear link tank to the commander of the battalion, who could then reply and have his reply relayed to the brigade commander. This was not entirely satisfactory, because it meant this business of relaying did to some extent limit the degree of contact between the two commanders, but at least it was a step in the right direction. And towards the end of my time in the tank brigade, some of these sets were installed and did give a considerable improvement. But the real answer didn't emerge until the new range of sets, the 19 set range, came into being at the beginning of the war. However, the number 14 set was a step in the right direction, and it was absolutely obvious that further development would be necessary, and this came along in due course. Now, allied to this was the problem of communication within the tank. For example, the tank commander with his head out of the turret had to be in communication with his driver and his gunner, and to some extent his operator. As this development went on and reached the 19-set stage, a harness, as it was called, was provided.
A harness.
With a number of control boxes which could be switched, so that by turning the switch, tank commander could talk to either gunner or driver, or on the short range set to an adjacent tank, not on the main net, but on a subsidiary net. For example, this enabled the section commander talk to his individual tanks without butting in on battalion communications, which is a very valuable advance. This happened by degrees, really, and stemming from the introduction of the 14 set, and didn't really reach its culmination until well on to the war, well on in the war, when the 19B set, which was a part of the set, but the 19 set, but in fact a separate set, within the same box, which provided external communication at short range with other adjacent tanks or with the crew members of the tank concerned. This was became more and more developed as the war went on, and remote control equipments were added so that an observer, for example, a Royal Artillery observer, using an armoured vehicle, could leave his vehicle and climb a ridge and look over the top without disclosing the tank, and still be able to talk over the wireless through the remote control equipment. This was incorporated into the harness, and in the end there was a very comprehensive set of communication equipment which gave a great deal of flexibility.
These kind of developments postdate the period I'm primarily interested in. Between the wars, there had been, as far as communications within tanks were concerned, experiments with things like laryngophones, had there not?
The laryngophone was never a success for some reason. That is so. speech was rather distorted, the equipment was never very satisfactory. But that really, I think, led to the development of microphones which were worn on a strap around the collar, which enabled, for example, the gunner to have his hands free while he was still able to use the microphone. These sort of devices gradually came into the harness, yes.
But between the wars, then, I take it that there were no satisfactory solutions.
No, but the problems were there, and they were being understood. Mm. And as the experience was gained and the designers came in on it, so eventually this progress was made in the field.
Yes. And let's just concentrate on a few more mundane, but I think pertinent problems. Would you like to give me a few comments on your experiences with the problem of the limited range of particularly the MBMC sets, and also the relationship between absolute range and ground conditions?
Yes, this is a big subject, really. With the MBMC set, range was very limited by, for example, trees, woods, forest conditions, buildings, and the mere topography of the land. The fact is that in those days, the sensitivity of the receivers and the power of the transmitters was very limited, and the designs, of course, the techniques of design were far from being advanced. I mean, by comparison with present-day wireless equipment, the attainable range was very limited, and not enough, really, to enable maneuver of armoured formations at any reasonable tactical distances beyond the line of sight, almost. Mm. 2 or 3 miles was a good range with the MBMC.
And what kind of ground conditions could affect by what kind of order the range of the MBMC sets below its ultimate level of 2 to 3 miles?
Again, the conditions are so very variable. If you want to communicate from one valley to the next, for example, you could do so with luck, but very possibly you would lose communication until your outstation had got out of the valley and halfway up the next hill, and then you might recover communication. And, of course, the tank commanders had to exercise their own judgment and their skill, really, in using country so as to try and maintain communication by avoiding obstacles to communication, such as deep depressions or wooded country, or even telephone lines, telegraph lines along the road, for example, could easily disrupt your communication if you were trying to communicate across them, whereas in line with your telephone wire, you might even occasionally get an increased range. But one learnt, after time and with experience, one learnt a good deal about the use of topography to keep communications in being and not lose them.
What sort of good deal?
It's very, very hard again to quantify. Very hard indeed. I think your tank commander, like your cavalryman, had to have an eye for country, but he had to add to this by trying to bear in mind the necessity to avoid breaking communication by reason of hazards in between which would interrupt it. I don't think you can quantify this at all. It's merely a question of know-how.
I really meant what were the sort of key features as far as topography was concerned, which a tank commander would be sensitive to and to ensure that his wireless communications didn't become interrupted.
Well, he might, for example, ring up or get on the air and say, look, I'm going down into the valley, and by the time I've crossed bridge point so-and-so and so, and I'm get up the slope to the other side, you may lose me. This would help enormously, you see, to maintain confidence.
Were communications much affected by whether signals were sent from a stationary tank on the one hand as compared with from a moving tank on the other?
Yes, I think to some extent that was so. A stationary tank is clearly better because the background noise of the rattling and so on would to some extent make it more difficult to decipher signals. On the other hand, a trained ear becomes terribly good with practice at discriminating between the wanted noise and the unwanted. And this again is a matter of training, you might call it, if you like, experience.
During this period we're talking about, 30 to 34, did you in practice find that you were able to communicate as effectively on the move as static?
If you really were stuck, you would stop. And then, of course, in addition to but once you got out of RT range, you could fall back on the on radio telegraphy, or wireless telegraphy, WT. And that gave you, you might say, a 50% extension, possibly, in those days. Although later on, you could work very much greater distances on WT.
Yes, yes. I've already asked you this question, but I come back to it because I think I was a little bit surprised by the apparent lightness with which you dismissed it. It's this problem of the human element. I have always assumed, and I've been slightly influenced by reading this thing, that part of the tank core's problems in getting the best from its wireless sets were the prejudices they felt against wireless, against its complexity. I'm just sort of putting this question to you for a second time to ask you whether you would regard the human element as being a significant handicap in the development of effective wireless communications.
Well, as an extreme example, which might throw a little light on this, I only too well remember Ajax, the company commander, one at that time Major Murray, who, out of devilment really, would fold his arms on the top of his turret and grin at the commanding officer 100 yards away while taking no notice at all of the radio. This sort of thing was possible, I suppose. There were, of course, a few characters who made a capital out of this sort of possibility, yes. But on the whole, I think the tank corps came to rely so much on the radio that it was only, well, I suppose the odd bit of devilment here and there that came into it. I think human problems, yes. But they didn't despise the radio. They, as time went on, they began to find out what it could give them. They came to regard it very highly.
In the final exercises that you took part in 1934, you, of course, acted as Brigade Signals Officer Tohoebo himself. I wonder if that gave you, through the close contact you had with him, any insight into why Hobo attached so much importance to wireless communications, as he obviously did.
Well, now, it's quite clear to me that Hobo appreciated that communications was really the key in manoeuvring an armoured force in battle. The firepower, the power of the tank in for fighting was of very little value unless it could be commanded and manoeuvred over reasonable distances, tactical distances at least, by some means. And radio was the means which gave him this control. This should be glaringly obvious, but Hobo was the chap who really appreciated that without radio he was unable to command.
Could you give me some personal reflections of those 34 exercises? I'm just interested in how you found it to be working with Hobo, what kind of fellow he was, how easy he was to get on with, what his characteristics were.
Well, I think the answer is one word. I find it extremely stimulating. I felt that I was stretched to my limit. I had to produce communication by one means or another. I had to bring all the problems that I felt were really limiting my ability to help him to his notice, and I had to talk to him about it, and I had to explain the difficulties. And I think that's really it. I knew that I was called upon to give him my best, and I tried to do it.
Mm. Any little stories that stick in your mind of that 34 experience as Hobo's Brigade Signals Officer?
Well, I think really the fact that he had his little stool built into his tank so he could sit comfortably on it, dangling his feet, and one of his boots was near my right ear. And I was in grave danger, if he became impatient, of receiving a blow from his foot. I think that is a sort of picture I think might indicate the kind of man Hobo was.
Let's move on to the period that you served at Bovington from 35 to 39. You had this gap of 1 year when you went on a course in 1934 to learn Japanese. Then you went to Bovington in 35. In order to set up the Tank Corps wireless wing, what was the idea behind this development exactly?
Well, this was the time when the cavalry were about to be mechanized, or were being mechanized, and it became necessary to widen the scope of the training to include the whole of the armored corps as it was about to be. And it was my job, or it was going to be my job at Bovington, at the wireless wing, to train battalion signal officers of their own units. That is, each regiment of the cavalry was to have its own signals officer of its own arm. The Royal Signals section was going to be disposed of, and communication within the battalion or regiment was to be a regimental responsibility. It was to be my job to train these signal officers, at least one for every regiment, and a number of NCO instructors whose job, when they returned to their units, was going to be to train their own personnel, their own operators, not any technical maintenance personnel, but their own operators, up to a sufficient standard to be able to maintain their equipment in working order by... up to the standard beyond which they clearly couldn't go. But they did have to have a certain amount of technical training, and I, in point of fact, had to include in my course some very elementary wireless theory so that they would understand. This is roughly parallel with what the driving and maintenance school taught their students about how engines work and transmissions and so on. The equivalent kind of standard was to be aimed at in communications equipment.
You set the wireless wing up more or less from scratch, did you?
Yes, I arrived at Bovington one day with, let me see, I think I had about six instructors, NCO instructors, very high class chaps, and two or three workshops personnel and a quartermaster sergeant and the odd general duty man. And I was allotted in Nissen Hut until we get on with it. Yeah, and I had to draw up the syllabus. I don't think I had any supervision, really. As far as the Directorate of Signals was concerned, I had no instructions from them at all as to my syllabus. I was simply told by the Armored Corps and my new boss at Bovington, the commandant of the school, to draw up my syllabus and be ready to start courses on such and such a date. Mm-hmm. Each course consisting of about a dozen or 14 officers, and parallel with that, roughly the same number of NCOs. And each course was to last, I think it was it 9 weeks, was it 12, 13 weeks, thereabouts. I've forgotten the precise length of the course. I think it was about 12 or 13 weeks.
Mm-hmm. What was the proportion of blackboard work to practical work?
Well, here, of course, again, I've got to try and get my memory to work. There was a good deal of blackboard work, or classroom work, I think I should call it, really, for a start. Take, for example, procedure. The students sitting at their desks would have to learn procedure verbally from desk to desk, as it were, instead of tank to tank, and be able to reproduce the kind of message passing procedure, or everything that goes with the talking on the wireless had to be done in the classroom, verbally from desk to desk to start with. That was the RT side. Then we had to teach them Morse. This was still very much a necessity in those days. And there were certainly, there was now at least an hour a day, or probably more than that, on the Morse key, starting from scratch in most cases at this stage, so entirely starting from scratch at the early stages, teaching them Morse. Luckily I had some excellent instructors who were able to maintain their interest in this. It might be thought to be rather dull learning Morse, but in point of fact the students were interested and keen and picked it up jolly well.
In setting up these courses, did you teach the kind of procedures that you had been developing with AFV signals up to 1934?
Yes.
Or did you take the opportunity to refine, modify, set up any new procedures?
Well, we did. In point of fact, what I did was to codify what I had learned and put it on paper, both the radio telephony and the Morse procedure, both of which were very considerably abbreviated from the Royal Corps Signals manuals and instruction, much more brief, and involving a certain amount of new material.
Like what?
Well, for example, Morse, it's a telegraphy. The procedure for that had developed over the years, and for our purposes was much too long-winded. The working on a net, for example, of a number of stations, up to possibly 50-odd, was an unknown thing in the army on telegraphy. And the procedure for this had to be worked out and codified and practiced and put into effect. But again, the Morse procedure was based very largely on the RT procedure, the radio telephony procedure, and was more or less parallel to it. But without going into the sort of actual detail of the procedure, it was a rather difficult thing to do, and it might take a bit of time. This didn't prove to be too much of a problem. We were able to do it, and our procedure, which we worked out at Bonington, became general throughout the Armoured Corps.
I think this is quite an interesting sort of self-educative process, because if you're very deeply and actively involved in something, you tend to develop by doing.
This is so, yes.
The process of thinking, prescribing, and then doing are not sort of set stages.
Not a bit, no.
And it's not until you get time to sort of stop, stand back a bit and look, that you actually do discover what you were doing.
This is very true.
And I wonder, when you came to codify those procedures, you actually were quite surprised at how much you had developed.
I think that it was. That it certainly is so. By the time we'd Romeoed off our sheets and produced our pamphlets, there was quite a fair volume of it. This is true.
Mm. Do you think this changeover that you've just described had practical benefits beyond that which the AFV signals phase represented? Was it an improvement?
I think myself that the Royal Armoured Corps themselves were very largely responsible. I think I merely gathered together and codified what was becoming their practice. And I think that there wasn't very much that I had to invent, although there was a little. I think I merely gathered the strands together and put them down on paper. I think that the Royal Armoured Corps, they were very live-minded people, and they found by trial and error how what worked and what didn't. And I think all I had to do, really, and honestly, was to get it together and establish it.
I know this isn't really your field, but I just wondered whether you noticed that with the developments of wireless procedures and with the development of wireless proficiency throughout this period of the 30s, whether those developments were accompanied by any changes in the doctrine, in the doctrines surrounding the use of armour.
Changes in the doctrines surrounding the use of armour? Do you mean tactically?
Yes.
I think these again developed with experience. For example, the newer sets gave greater ranges, and with the greater ranges, the problem of security became more and more important and dangerous. And I think that